From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in April when the Pulitzer Committee awarded their prize for history to Heather Ann Thompson, the author of the remarkable book Blood in the Water, The Attica Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. That book is the result of years of work, and legal authorities have only made that work more difficult. From the beginning, photographs were destroyed, documents withheld, names redacted. That's hardly changed. But Thompson's steadfast efforts have produced a book that tells the story in a way that not only is true to history, but might help us create better and more humane conditions in the future. The Attica story tends to focus on the events that began on September 9, 1971, when nearly 1,300 prisoners took control of the Attica Correctional Facility. But really, it was years of mistreatment that planted the seeds that finally flowered on that September day. Thompson's book exposes the crimes that happened not only during the uprising, but the kinds of torture and crimes that happened after it was over, and then the cover-up. Heather Ann Thompson is the author of Blood in the Water. She's a historian at the University of Michigan. She writes extensively on the history of policing, mass incarceration, and the current criminal justice system for many publications, including the New York Times. She has served on the National Academy of Sciences Blue Ribbon panel that studied the causes and consequences of mass incarceration in the United States. And for now, I will stop there with her resume. It's great to have Dr. Thompson in studio. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
Surprised at the Pulitzer's award with this? I mean, there was not a lot of surprise among people who know this issue well. My colleague Gary Craig and many others who've reported so extensively, they were not surprised because they thought the book was extraordinary. Were you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's nice to hear, but I was utterly stunned. I didn't know the book was in the running, and I had no idea that was the day that it would be announced. So I was actually teaching a class when I got the call and was utterly stunned, but very grateful because I thought it would mean that more people would read about Attica and kind of learn more about the history.
Well, and listeners, we're going to go through a number of things this hour. We're going to talk about the book, the research process, which I think it's instructive to hear what Heather Ann Thompson went through and the opportunities that came up. But that does not mean that all of a sudden, well, they've stopped redacting names or all the documents are out or everything is transparent. Far from it. And that's an important part of the story because, as we will discuss and as Dr. Thompson discusses in various places, including the book, Attica was not only a tragedy, but a missed opportunity to really improve the system. And the system got worse for so many years. So there's a lot to talk about this hour. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me ask you first how you came across the subject or decided to write this book.
Well, that's a great question because I knew nothing about U.S. prisons. I had never been in a prison and, like so many of your listeners, probably didn't think a whole lot about prisons. I came to Attica because I knew about the uprising of 71 through some videos, through some mentions in textbooks, but I had no idea that it was anything other than a civil rights protest behind bars. And I was a civil rights historian, and I thought, oh, you know, that would be a great book to write. Having absolutely no idea that that the reason that more had not been written was that the state of New York had made it impossible to access the story. Also, the story was ongoing. Even as I began this project, there was many obstacles in the way of the survivors having any modicum of justice. So they were still making history as the book was being written. And frankly, the journey of writing the book was, for me, a journey about really understanding what our nation's criminal justice system is about. None of that was what brought me, actually, to the topic, but it became central to the topic.
And you had, you know, certain things that happened along the way of your research process that sort of opened it up to kind of a cache of documents here and these opportunities that came, but they did not come because, you know, for example, New York State or the authorities were calling people like Heather Ann Thompson saying, you know, for years, I think we've been a little less transparent than we should be. Let's open this up. It didn't really happen that way, did it?
No. In fact, the way that historians write their books is that they tend to go to archives where, you know, libraries that have collected all relevant documents related to any given event. And we ask for, you know, box 30, folder 20, and we reconstruct what happened in the past. In this case, every document that I wanted to see, every file I wanted to see that the state of New York had collected, both about the uprising, but also about the criminal trials that followed it, the civil trials that followed it, it was almost impossible to get these records. And so I did the next thing, which was to file Freedom of Information requests and to keep poking and poking, actually to try to come at this from different angles, you know, know, not an Attica collection, but maybe, you know, what were the union files revealing, or, you know, what did the state health department have to say? But ultimately, the book could not have been written without a combination of the survivors who were just determined to keep this story alive, to tell the story that that they had experienced, and what I say in the book, which was lucky breaks, which is to say, happening upon documents that there is no question in my mind the state of New York didn't know were there, and that really changed everything. It allowed me to tell a part of the Attica story that had not been told before.
You still had to pull together those documents, though, and try to get them organized. So many different, you know, whether there were personal letters written or documents from different days, not necessarily organized very well. And you had this opportunity in front of you, but it was a huge responsibility because you have said, and I've seen you say in different interviews, you know, you had to weigh what this would mean to the people involved who've gone through a lot of pain over the years, right?
That's right. And one of the to the extent that there's been any real controversy about the book, it has been about what I've chosen to include in it. And what I chose to include was anything that I learned. The decision was made basically because of my profession. As a historian, you can't cherry pick what parts of the story you might want to tell. And I was haunted by that because while that was my obligation and while I felt it was important to reveal anything that we could possibly know about Attica on these pages, I was well aware that there was great responsibility with that. In other words, to tell family members things that had happened to their loved ones. I knew that that was going to open old wounds, to identify state troopers or corrections officers who had committed real harm on the day of the retaking. I knew that that would open up problems for them. But yet, I really also felt that there was no choice. It was 45 years past the time when the state of New York should have made all this available to the survivors and the public.
The book is available in paperback now. It's Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Dr. Heather Ann Thompson, my guest for the hour, the author of the book, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Listeners, if you haven't thought much about Attica or even the issue of incarceration, prison reform at large, I defy you to pick up this book and not feel changed when you read this. Because for some of our listeners, I think what we should do is sort of remind people exactly what was happening at the time. Because some of our listeners will either think, well, you know, I'm in my 20s or 30s. I don't really know. Isn't that kind of an old story? It's 1971. Other listeners might say, you know, I remember the coverage, but again, kind of an old story. This is not an old story because of what this did. You know, you've heard of Rockefeller drug laws. We've heard debates and conversations about what prison reform, what sentencing reform would mean today. There are roots that go all the way back to Attica. So this is not an old story. But for those who need that setting set for them in 1971, set that scene for us.
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine in this day we live in now, where we now have more people locked up than any other country on the globe. We now treat all social ills through the criminal justice system, and we have become one of the world's most punitive nations. So for young people in particular, it's very hard to imagine that that wasn't always the case. In 1971, when Attica happens, it was actually a moment of great optimism that both civil rights in communities like Rochester, but also civil rights behind bars, human rights, that conditions were pretty bad, and that by simply addressing them, by recognizing that people who were serving time had not given up their humanity, that they deserve basic human rights, that we could make a more just criminal justice system. So in 71, we were actually talking about reducing prison numbers. We were talking about the nation as a whole was quite opposed to the death penalty, for example. The nation as a whole was very skeptical that we could trust what happened behind bars, that we needed more transparency. Well, Attica is central to why it is that in 1972, right after Attica, we make an abrupt shift. The abrupt shift is to see prisoners as not worthy of human rights, to see them as animals, to see the role of prisons to no longer be rehabilitation, but to be punitive to an extraordinary degree. And I argue, at least in the book, that we can't understand that shift without understanding the importance of having gotten the Attica story so wrong.
I don't know if there is a way to identify what was, for me, the single saddest or hardest part of the book, but we're going to get to what I think, if I had to choose, it would be probably the official government response, what Rockefeller, what the president were saying, what the media coverage was like. That was extraordinarily sad. And for listeners who don't know or don't remember, that's important to revisit that. But before we even get there, just what happened during those days, and that sort of the myths that started to come out. Mm-hmm. One of the myths was, well, you know, there were days of negotiations, and things just broke down. Mm-hmm. It stalled. There was nowhere to go. That's taking over the prison by force was the only option here. And why don't you take me through some of what those, especially the early days, and remind our listeners what they were trying to accomplish here. I mean, we're talking about trying to correct mistreatment, right?
Well, imagine, again, it's almost incomprehensible today to imagine that in 1971, when these men had the opportunity, really through a series of completely accidental events that they were able to take over the prison, when they have this opportunity to move all into one yard, D yard, and tell the world really what prison conditions were like, and bring the media in to share their stories and bring observers in to make sure that the state would negotiate them with them fairly. We can't imagine that because there would be no media in prison today. But at the time, this was a really extraordinary, really moment in participatory democracy. You had, as you say, nearly 1,300 men who had elected leaders out of each of their cell blocks to represent them, to negotiate with the state, and to ask for, as you note, very, very basic things. You know, in the first few hours, there were some demands like, you know, a lot of attention was paid to travel to a non-imperialist country, you know, but those were voted down. What the men in the yard voted for were very, very basic changes. These are men being fed on 63 cents a day. These are men with really just outrageous parole rules that you could never really get parole. Couldn't see family. You couldn't see your children if you weren't married to their mother. I mean, all of these kind of basic things that they wanted remedied. And over those 4 days, there was every possibility that this could settle. And indeed, all the observers there who were a range of, you know, reporters like Tom Wicker from the New York Times or, you know, radical lawyers like Bill Kunstler, but also a lot of Republican state representatives from New York, there was possibility. And it all falls apart very, very quickly.
Well, tell our listeners what that means, because, again, the narrative in the public was one thing, and what was actually happening inside was very different.
So what happens on the inside is that the guys know that they cannot fully surrender unless the state of New York agrees to let them surrender without major repercussions, meaning that they won't be physically assaulted, meaning that they will not have additional criminal penalties levied on them. And this is a real concern because one of the things that happens most horrifically in the middle of this is that a guard who had been overrun in the first hours of this prison takeover died of his injuries, William Quinn. And when William Quinn dies, everyone in that yard understands that they can all be on the hook for felony murder. And it was really critical to them that they had some measure of security that they could surrender essentially peacefully and that whoever the real perpetrators were, you know, that the state would confine any inquiry to that. Well, the state of New York, specifically Governor Rockefeller, was not interested in a discussion of amnesty. Amnesty was the sticking point. But there was still an opportunity to remedy this. The observers asked Rockefeller to come to Attica, to stand outside of the prison, not even to go in their yard, and to assure these men personally that they could surrender and not be harmed. This would not have been unheard of. FDR went to a prison. John Lindsay, just the year before, had gone to a New York City jail in rebellion. Rockefeller said no way. The consequences of that proved tragic, because once he decided he wasn't going to come, there was, in his view, only one way out, which was this brutal, brutal retaking.
We're going to start working in some of your phone calls, but I in some ways that kind of pauses the story, and we're going to continue to work through it. But as we do, we'll work in some of your feedback, and I'll go ahead and take our first call now. It's John in Scottsville. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Evan, you were saying that the thing that affected you the most was the lack of accountability by the state, the agencies of authority. And I wanted to say that the thing that affected me the most, and by the way, this book really did a number on me, was the racism, the absolutely blatant racism of the communities around the prison. I don't even want to name it because the people are still, a lot of them are still there. Their families are there. But just the racism, it knocked me over. And I wondered if that is still alive within the system, the prison system. Not only the people that run the prisons, but also the state police, for example, which seemed to be quite guilty of that at the time.
John, it's a great question. Stay on the line with us, and we'll see how Dr. Thompson wants to answer that. If that's still sort of present and part of the fabric now.
Well, indeed, okay. And I really appreciate your comment. Thank you for that. I'm really gratified, actually, that is a message that came through in the book, because it is one of the most sort of stunning, really horrific elements of the story, that you can't understand the amount of abuse that goes on in that prison, both during the retaking and after, without understanding that the folks inside were not seen as equal as human beings, that there was such a level of racism, as you mentioned. And that is one of the reasons why the book resonates so much today, because not only did it not go away, but the racial disproportionality in our prisons is even worse now than it was then, particularly the way the drug war has been waged. We know that more white folks both sell and use drugs than black folks, but that's not at all represented in our prison system, and that's not where we deploy police officers. So I'm grateful if that message comes through. There are moments in this book that were so difficult to write because the sheer it was a lynching. I mean, it was, you know, prisoners being forced to give the white power salute. The level of barbarism, the torture that goes on, it's just breathtaking. And it is a cautionary tale for today, because we don't see inside of prisons today. They are closed institutions, even though we pay for them, even though we trust them, even though they have abysmal failure rates of, you know, recidivism. And imagine what goes on behind those closed doors. Attica's story is a cautionary tale. It tells us that we should demand to know. There should be accountability in our prisons.
Thank you.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
Your response. Nice job.
Really thank
nice
you.
Job.
John, thank you for the phone call. And sort of to be a little bit more specific, John, you know, was talking about what I found the most sad or tragic. And it's hard to pick any one thing. But again, it the tragedy of the official response to this is what has perpetuated that system. Because as we're going to talk about as we go throughout our second half hour, this was an opportunity, as gruesome as Attica was, if there were transparency, to create the kind of public understanding and then maybe reform then, as opposed to going in the opposite direction. And I found that to be tragic. And Heather writes in the book about the retaking and how violent it was. And again, if you don't know the story, there were officers who would... were essentially indiscriminately, according to many witnesses and many accounts, just murdering people, unarmed people, shooting some in the head, shooting some multiple times. And then there were conversations that observers heard of, you know, should we let this person die, bleed out and die, or kill them now? And those things were happening in those hours when, again, this narrative that, well, this was the only way to do it because of what Rockefeller and many said. So Heather writes in the book, perhaps no congressman was more outspoken, though, than Attica observer Herman Badillo. Mm-hmm. He tried to make clear to his fellow members of the House that the retaking had been a tragedy of monumental proportions. There should have been no rush to end the rebellion in this violent way, particularly, he pointed out, since the prisoners were going nowhere and the hostages were being protected. Even the early demand for transport to a non-imperialist country had had no support at all as the rebellion wore on, he explained, which in his view was extraordinary because, as he said, I understand there were more than 200 prisoners who had life sentences. And so some people weren't buying it, but you had Governor Rockefeller saying things like, quote, we can all be grateful that the skill and courage of the state police and corrections officers supported by the National Guard and sheriff's deputies saved the lives of 29 hostages and that their restraint held down casualties among prisoners as well. He offered positive feelings about the decision to take Attica with force. And, you know, this went all the way up to the White House. So let me just read again here. You talk about what shocks you or what, as John says, you know, just sort of knocked him over. we're reading these things that, if you don't know the Attica story, this is it hurts to read this stuff. President Nixon was in the Oval Office discussing all that he had just learned about the retaking with fellow Republicans Bob Dole, Alexander Haig, and H.R. Haldeman. And quote, "They killed seven of the guards. A bloody business," Nixon told his aides. And worse, he went on, quote, "One of the guards had been castrated." Nixon was clear to the men assembled that, in his view, quote, "Rockefeller handled it well because, as the president put it, quote, you see, it's the black business. He had to do it," end quote. I don't know if there was a sentence in the book that landed more with that. And I know, as a white male, and we've had a lot of conversations about race, especially in the last year, there's a lot of listeners of color saying that should not surprise you. But there's still going to be some that really hurts. What do you think, Dr. Thompson?
Well, I think that's the importance of reading what actually took place. The fact is that the discussions we're having today about black lives not mattering, or about the way in which race so distorts and destroys our society, or more specifically racism, when you look at Attica, it's just laid bare. There's no two ways to interpret it. There's no alternative narrative you can provide for it. When you have the leaders of our country making clear that as long as the death toll at Attica was black folks, that it was okay. And frankly, even Nixon's understanding that the prisoners had killed the hostages, right, that this is what he's referring to, and so, you know, who cares if we went in and killed them, even that was a lie. It's so interesting that the more people that I talked to doing this book, whether they were troopers or corrections officers or prisoners, the one stunning theme in the whole thing was that the state officials, the real puppeteers behind the whole thing, the elected officials, were the ones that at any point in time could have diverted this, could have changed it, could have even repaired it in its wake, and at every moment instead fueled the worst in people, stepped away from people in need, and literally turned a blind eye, first condoned and sanctioned, and then turned a blind eye to the repercussions, the trauma that these overwhelmingly black and brown prisoners, although not exclusively, there were white prisoners tortured as well, given all racial epithets as well, by the way, for having stood with black and brown prisoners. Those people were traumatized, post-traumatic stress, and so were the guards. So it's the state officials. And that's why today, when we see stories of shootings of unarmed people, or we hear about, you know, who's being indicted or who's not, our first question should be, who's got the power to make those decisions, and are they being transparent?
And I know there are some listeners, and maybe we'll hear from them in our second half hour, who are going to make the argument, well, these are prisoners, they're incarcerated for a reason. And we still have this national mentality, probably more than most industrialized or quote-unquote developed countries, right, that we look at people who are incarcerated as lesser than. That was clearly part of the goal of the state, wasn't it? To portray what happened, these 1,300 men as animals, mm-hmm. as lesser than, and deserving of what they got, as opposed to the reality of what was actually happening. And by the way, I mentioned that passage about the castrating a guard. There was a lot of stories like that going on, weren't there?
Well, first of all, listeners should know that one of the reasons why these rumors ran so rampant is that they were being literally placed there. The FBI was on the scene, riling up state troopers, telling them stories of atrocities from inside of the yard, telling them that the prisoners were making the hostages stand at attention, and that, you know, should they falter, that they would kill them. I mean, things that just simply weren't happening. But it played into a racial narrative that many viewers were totally comfortable with. That's why they didn't question it, right? To be told that a black prisoner had castrated a white guard made utter sense to them. To be told that all these black and brown prisoners had killed the hostages made sense to them. I mean, it really lays bare the heart of our assumptions as white America and the heart of the abuses that prisoners face, because we do deny humanity. To those callers or listeners or just citizens who, though, would say that, well, when you do the crime, you do the time, one of the problems with that analysis analysis is, number one, that in 1971, just like today, you'd be shocked at who's actually behind bars. You know, this idea that everyone's a serial killer or, you know, a rapist or a murderer, there were 19-year-olds in Attica there on parole violations. There were so many men there who had served their country in Vietnam and were in Attica for robberies committed because they were drug addicted coming back from Saigon. These were men who were mentally ill. These were men who suffered. And as a result of all of that, we can't assume, A, who's in prison. We can't make judgments wholesale about their worthiness to their humanity, because just because a jury has sentenced them, no jury has sentenced them to torture, to abuse, to the things that these men endured. So we, as a country, we either believe that our system is there to protect and to make people better and whole. And if we do, then we cannot run our prisons as torture chambers. And so that's really the issue. It's not the issue of should people be serving time. We could have a different discussion about that. It's really about who are these people and how do we treat the human beings behind bars.
We're going to spend the rest of the hour doing two things, listeners. We're going to take your calls. We have a number of calls lined up, and we want to hear from you on this. And we're also going to talk about what came out of Attica, the Rockefeller drug laws, how we looked at sentencing, the punitive nature of prison, and the opportunity that was lost there. How it would have gone differently, and it's impossible to know exactly. But if there was transparency, if there was real transparency and honesty on the part of authorities in the state, how Dr. Thompson views things maybe perhaps going differently, and what we can learn today, because some of her work today, much of her work today, I mean, even Congressman Paul Ryan talks about sentencing reform. You know, there's a lot of talk on the national level on all sides about these issues, and we're going back to 1971 with this book. So this is not an old story. So James, John, Don, we're going to get your phone calls when we come back. The book is called Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Heather Ann Thompson is my guest. She won the Pulitzer Prize for this book. It's out in paperback now, and we're right back with her next. Coming up in our second hour, is there such a thing as clean meat? Well, companies like Memphis Meat say the answer is yes. They're using stem cells to grow meat in a lab. No more animal-based agriculture. They think it's much better for the environment. They think it's the way to even get vegans to think about eating meat again. Is that true? Would you do it? What are your thoughts about it? Any questions about it? We're going to talk about it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's get to some of your phone calls. James in Brighton, next on the line. Go ahead, James.
Thank you for taking my call. Professor Thompson had called just for one issue, and that was my brother-in-law was one of the doctors there. But listening to the other conversations, I recall that I was student teaching at the time, and where you're going to be talking tonight at Geneseo, I had a couple students in Hornell whose uncles were guards there, and it was very traumatic for them at the time. And I was challenged when I had made remarks that I heard that some of the stories that were being broadcast were lies. It was very emotional. But then Rockefeller came to Geneseo, to where you're going to be talking tonight. I never saw such a student protest in my life. This was about 2 months after Attica. He barely from the front door coming up the stairs into the ballroom where you're talking, you couldn't get through. The students were packed, and it was all in reaction to what had happened at Attica. But Rockefeller smiled. He shook hands. He said he understood and came through. My former brother-in-law, who was a doctor, was one of the doctors that was pulled into Attica immediately after. And he had been a combat doctor in Vietnam, and he told me that what he saw in Attica was much worse than anything that he'd gone through in Vietnam. And I'd like to hear your thoughts and comments of your interviews with the doctors who were there.
All right, James, thanks for the phone call. And James is doing my job for me. You want to let our listeners know what you're doing tonight at Geneseo?
Yes, giving a talk at 7 on the book. And please come join us in this conversation. I really appreciate your call because it reminds me to point out two things. One, that there were a lot of heroes in this story, too. A lot of the doctors that came in after the retaking, by the way, who many of whom were turned away at the door and were told told to leave the prison and were not allowed to do their jobs because they were being prevented by some of the more abusive law enforcement officers on the scene who would prefer to see these men die. But there were heroes and men who were so haunted by what they saw on the 13th that they would come to court many years later and tell these stories, which was really important because the prisoners had been telling about this abuse and no one believed them. The doctors helped to corroborate the stories that of abuse that they had witnessed. They were, too, traumatized by it, as you mentioned. Not just doctors. I mean, some of the troopers were traumatized by what they saw. And indeed, the whole issue of Rockefeller is at the core of this because this is a man who was so bent on getting his own career off the ground, being a president one day in a party that was becoming increasingly conservative, that he was willing to sacrifice not just the prisoners, but the civilian employees and the CO employees that were taken hostages. They were all dispensable to his political ambition. And the students knew that, and the communities knew that. So everywhere he went in the wake of Attica, he was greeted with a huge throngs of protesters. There was calls to impeach him. One of the former assemblymen in the state of New York, Arthur Eve, actually wanted to impeach Rockefeller. And so this was a real clash of ideas, a clash of cultures, but at bottom, those who paid the highest prices for this were the prisoners and the hostages who had suffered so much for that ambition.
Today is the 46th anniversary of the uprising, and 7 p.m. tonight, Heather Ann Thompson is giving a talk titled The Attica Prison Uprising and Why It Matters Today. That's 7 p.m. tonight in the Newton at Newton Hall, room 202 on the SUNY Geneseo campus. That's a free and open to the public talk, and she'll have a book signing and reception to follow that. So 7 p.m. tonight at SUNY Geneseo, The Attica Uprising and Why It Matters Today, 46 years after, as she just mentioned, the 13th, September 13th, 1971. Let's get back to your phone calls. John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Your guest makes these prisoners sound so noble. That kind of bothers me, but I have to say, well, I have a cousin who was he's recovering from a beating he took from, he's a prison guard at Attica. Got beaten up by a prisoner a couple of years ago. Still recovering from that, but I was at University of Buffalo back then, and I knew a lot of policemen. My dad was a policeman, my uncle was a policeman, and the rumor was, before the taking, that as you say, the castrations, torture of prison guards, that type of thing was going on. So the police community was in sync with that thinking. And I remember going to the protests after the taking in downtown Buffalo, mainly UB, Buff State students, and we heard William Kunstler speak I think it might have been Lafayette Square. I can't remember right now, but they had a heck of a crowd there. As soon as Kunstler left in a limo or some type of vehicle, I can't remember what it was, the police just came and attacked us, and they were really irritated. In fact, before the protest, when I got there, I asked the policeman where Lafayette Square was or whatever, and he says, "You don't want to go there." He told me point blank. I go, okay. I just thought I didn't understand the anger that the police had, but I know my father was angry, my uncle was angry, and other policemen I knew were very angry, and they really believed this was going on inside that prison, and I think these prisoners I just think are put up too much on a pedestal. In your conversation, and I haven't read your book yet, but I will.
I really appreciate your comments, and I hope that you will have an opportunity to look at the book, and I wonder if you might feel a little better about the conversation after reading it, because I certainly in the book I don't I don't believe I put anyone on a pedestal. When people have committed crimes in this book, no matter who they are and what hats they wear, I tell that story. I'm very clear that there were heroes and villains on all sides of this story. But one of the things that you said really struck me, which is that someone that you know who was hurt by a prisoner recently. And the thing that the message really of the book is that this is exactly the problem with the system. The system has become so overcrowded, so punitive, so ugly, that whether you work there or whether you are contained in there, it's a terrible place. Guards are injured, prisoners are injured, and if this is the place where we hope that people will have a good job or people will have an opportunity to redeem themselves or to reenter society or to get clean or whatever the goal is in this instance, we are going about it the worst way possible. So whoever is injured in this institution should be absolutely sympathized with. And broader, you know, as voters, we have this opportunity to say, wait a minute, you know, this violence is inevitable.
Well, we'll agree to disagree on this issue. I think that the prison system, and my cousin being a prison guard at Attica, has given me some insight, and I know some other people that have been prison guards at Attica. I think there's been a lot of reforms in the prison system. I think I knew Richard Matt, who was a prison escapee from Eastern New York a couple of years ago. He was actually shot because he pointed a gun at a state trooper, I guess. I know the guy that he killed. I mm-hmm. knew his son, I should say. Mm-hmm. And this Richard Matt, who happens to be white, viciously murdered my friend's father, dismembered him, tortured him before the death.
This is the type of
prison reform that we've gotten, where a guy like that, it had Club Med going for him over in the prison near Albany.
All right, John, I gotta jump in. First of all, I'm very sorry to hear about a family or a friend lost like that. I think we all are. Club Med? You think it's Club Med in the prison system today, Dr. Thompson?
Well, I mean, I think that the problem is that we get so little information out of prisons. We either get the information from the people who were locked up because they could send us a letter, or we get the information from a CO because we might be related to them or we might know them as friends. And so our information that comes out of prisons is always coming from one side or the other. It's very, very difficult. There's no public transparency whatsoever. And in every institution that's closed like that, terrible things happen on all sides. Attica in particular is still so traumatized from 1971. You know, we know that guards get injured. We also know that, you know, one of the prisoners there, George Williams, was, you know, literally almost killed. And this was due to guards. So my point, I think we actually might agree, which is that these institutions, whatever reforms have happened, they have clearly become so tense, so volatile, that they're not safe to work in. They're not safe to be locked up in them. And I think the point of the book is actually something that most citizens would agree on, which is that if we pay for these institutions, we trust them, we want them to do something for our society that makes it better. And clearly, if guards are being injured, if prisoners are being injured, and if people are not coming out of it better people or coming home at the end of their shift, okay, we've got a real problem.
Yes, we need to make a society sort of a judgment of the evidence. If our goal is just to be punitive when people commit crimes of different kinds and varieties, then we should say so. But the evidence now tells us that if you want people who commit crimes who are not going to be incarcerated for life to come back and be productive citizens, that we are doing it the wrong way. And Attica was a tragedy. How many people died at Attica, Dr. Thompson?
39, both yep. hostages and prisoners. This is why the story that I tell in this book, and I you know, talk to a lot of the surviving guards and prisoners, and I think that they will all tell you their stories are here. You know, their stories are in here.
And You know, you can learn more from Dr. Thompson. Let me mention again the two events, because then I'll take more of your calls in a second here. I mentioned that tonight, 7 p.m. at Geneseo, the talk is the Attica Prison Uprising and Why It Matters Today, 46 years after the uprising, September 13, 1971. So 7 p.m. tonight in Newton Hall at SUNY Geneseo. It's free. There's a book signing. And then Heather's going to speak tomorrow at RIT. The talk is at 4 p.m. in Ingle Auditorium. That is also free and open to the public, focusing on the legacy of the Attica Prison Uprising in 1971 and why it matters today. So 4 p.m. tomorrow at RIT, 7 p.m. tonight at Geneseo. When it comes to what happened afterwards, had this been a truly transparent process, had Rockefeller, had everyone involved, had, as I say, involved in the decision-making process, in understanding the evidence, had there not been any kind of a cover-up, what do you think would have been different?
Everything. I think your listeners will be surprised if they get the book to see that the only the first third is actually about this event in the prison. The rest of the book is about what happens afterwards. And what I was able to finally discover through the research was that there was a massive, massive cover-up. State officials did not want the public to know what had happened at Attica. It didn't want the survivors to know what had happened to their loved ones, whether they were hostages or prisoners. And the consequences of that for the nation and for local folks was immeasurable. For local folks, it meant decades of trauma, an inability to have closure and to heal and to know what had happened to loved ones and who was responsible for that. And for the nation, it meant that we had been sold a false bill of goods. After Attica, the world, really, because this went out on the AP News, it went out in the international news, and it went out in the New York Times front page, LA Times front page. The world was told that the prisoners killed the hostages, not law enforcement. The prisoners had done all sorts of unimaginable acts against the hostages. And because the focus then became on that, not on where we had been, which was how do we make a society safer for everybody and a system that is actually just and humane, we took a seriously, seriously wrong path. And the consequences for corrections officers, for the incarcerated, and for the families of both groups have been pretty horrific. And we now have a system with more people locked up than anyone else on the planet. We now have, some estimate, almost 100 million Americans with a criminal justice record. We now have more than 7.5 million people under some form of correctional control. And our recidivism rate is staggering. So there is few people who would say that this thing is working. And the question is, how do we get it right? And I would argue we can't get it right till we start listening to the people that are actually on the inside, those who work there, those who are kept there, and what do they say needs doing?
You will probably still find people who followed the events of what happened and won't believe who killed the hostages,
right?
Won't believe the reality. I would urge you, you know, share this book with them. Share Blood and Water with them. Start there, because this is a historical and journalistic undertaking that at least helps us understand reality of what happened. Let me get back to your phone calls. Don in East Rochester next. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. If the author could comment on what I see as a very big and important event that happened at Attica, was that all racial groups in the prison were united for one particular goal. One of the ways that the prison administrations in any state in the United States keeps control is it divides the prisoners up into racial groups. You know, it divides them up, it sets them up against each other so that they are fighting amongst each other and not against the guards and the administration. The Attica Rebellion and other rebellions that took place in prisons at that time, Attica wasn't the only one, had an incredible degree of racial unity. After all, it's the whites that are in the prison are poor whites. They're not rich whites. The African-Americans that are in there are poor African-Americans. The Hispanics that are in there are poor Hispanics. That's why you had Herman Badillo there, because there was a significant number of Hispanic prisoners that were involved. And I believe they had Arthur Eve that was also involved, an African-American from Buffalo, because there were a large number of African-Americans. It was an incredible situation where all racial and ethnic groups were able to coalesce and unite and to fight back and make demands on the system.
That's absolutely right. I'm so glad that you shared that. That's right. And I think the book will tell listeners the story of how that happens. You know, how it is that folks who had been divided by job categorization and who lived in an institution with such segregation, when it really came down to it, and this was the shine time, the time when you had to tell the public what is it that needs to happen in prisons to make them more humane, that did cross racial lines. Folks did stand together. And perhaps even most kind of horrifically, when you think about how it ended, if you see the images of what happens after the retaking, when these men are stripped and they are beaten and many of them are injured, one of the most startling things about the photography is you quickly realize the power of your point, which is that these were not all African-American and Latino prisoners. These were also white prisoners. And as their naked bodies are being lined up and they are all being beaten, you see a real rainbow of colors of men. And that was this moment, I think, when it really does become clear that no matter who is behind bars, they did share one thing, and that was this desire, again, to have basic human rights. And that did cross racial lines, no question about it.
Let me grab one more phone call. Jim in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jim. Got to keep it tight.
Good mid-afternoon.
Yep.
I want to make a statement. A friend of mine, he was a generation ahead of me, ex-Tuskegee Airman, who was shooting down German Waldcraft over the Italian peninsula with pistons engines before the jet engine was even involved. But he was a toxicologist, and he worked at the Monroe County Medical Office because Wyoming County was so underdeveloped, they really didn't have money for a Class A medical examiner's office. And they had people standing by in Rochester. We had more facilities, better facilities, more technology to do an autopsy to find out what happened. And when they found out that all of those guys were shot by gun, or died, were killed by gunshot wounds, and they took the information to their boss, a young guy, he was a Dr. Edelman, I think it was his name, Jewish chap. And Nelson Rockefeller put so much pressure and stress on him, he went into a deep depression and cracked up. And that caused Nelson Rockefeller probably the presidency of the United States. So you're absolutely right, but about what happened. And it was so tragic because a lot of lives were destroyed because of political ambition and the absolute refusal to face the facts. Except when a lot of whites got killed, a few of them opened up their eyes and said, look, this government is against us just like it is against all poor people. So we're going to have to come to grips with that in this country if this thing is going to survive and move ahead.
Thank you so much for that. You know, you're absolutely right to remind everybody that, as I said in the beginning, there were some real heroes in this story, and one of them was the local coroner who could see clearly that the prisoners had not slipped the throats and stabbed the hostages to death, and that they had all been killed by gunfire, and he went public at great, enormous, tragic personal cost. And there were men like him in there, and this the way in which the people with power sacrificed so many other lives for their own political ambition, and frankly, because they denied that the people inside's lives meant anything, is really the humbling takeaway, I think, from the book. And I also, in addition to reading the book and that story, I hope you all will see a really powerful documentary done by a local filmmaker, Christine Christopher, Criminal Injustice at Attica, because it really shows you the visuals of what took place in this uprising and also how powerful that political cover-up was.
I will just say to our listeners, I don't remember exactly where, but somewhere in sort of the wrap, closing pages of the book, Dr. Thompson, who has given us this work of journalism, history, scholarship, reminds us of, I think you used the phrase, the politics of the ironic, the 1960s and 70s, when we had these different events. There was Attica, but there was Kent State, there was the 1968 DNC, mm-hmm. and every time,
Wounded Knee.
You know, we always seem to respond by ceding more authority and more authoritarian power, even though that seemed to be the actual roots of the trouble and the politics of the Iranic, if I'm phrasing it correctly. But the bottom line is the historical work that goes into this book, Blood in the Water. You can see why it wins the Pulitzer Prize if you pick it up. And you can meet Heather and hear a lot more about what went into this book and the legacy of Attica. Tonight, 7 p.m. at SUNY Geneseo. That's at Newton Hall. 7 p.m. tonight. It's free. It's a discussion on why it matters today, Attica, and why it matters today. Tomorrow, 4 p.m., Ingle Auditorium. Same subject, also free. So Dr. Thompson, Heather Ann Thompson is going to be there both tonight and tomorrow. And we just so much appreciate you sharing your time and the efforts with us in studio today. Thank you so much for this.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And Dr. Heather Ann Thompson continues with the work, as we mentioned. She's been part of Blue Ribbon panels. We know that this is still a national issue, and it goes on. The book is Blood in the Water, out in paperback now. Short break. More Connections coming up.